Well, okay, so we'll begin as best we can. So as was mentioned before, and when Mass was ending up, we are going to record this because in our current situation, folks sometimes have their own discomfort about coming to things in person, so here we are. So just know that in advance, just audio recording, nothing video related. So we'll begin with a little prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and Holy Spirit, amen. You can say it with me. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death, amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and Holy Spirit, amen. So this is maybe a slightly longer version of a talk I gave a couple of weeks ago for the Knights of Columbus. So for those who are there, this will sound quite familiar. And here's what we're going to do. So the title is In Search of the Catholic Vote, Why It's Complicated. And just as a disclaimer right off the bat, I'm not going to focus a lot of my time, as I have done in prior election talks, on like the hot button issues that are driving some of the conversational pieces. In part because they've been talked about quite a bit already on the social media pages, in the Catholic commentaries, by the bishops. Different bishops have weighed in different ways. So as this goes along, you'll kind of get my take on it. Don't worry, you'll figure it out. But this is a little different focus and emphasis, just so you know in the beginning. But I think you'll find it interesting. I hope so anyhow, right? So what I want to try and do, instead of landing on like the issues, is just try and shed some light a little bit on what I think many faithful Catholics find to be in every election cycle such a maddening question, which is, why can't we all be on the same page about this? It's always, I hear every election cycle as a pastor, the frustration rising in people's voices, including my own. Why aren't the bishops saying more about this? Why do the Catholics line up on different sides of that? You know, how does one handle Catholic politicians on a variety of levels, locally or nationally, who seem to be living one way or voting one way while the church says something else? So how does one make sense of all of this is kind of the question, right? And so all that I'm going to simply do, I guess, is kind of walk through a little bit of a history about how in this country, Catholics have always had this sort of, I wouldn't say uneasy, but maybe unusual place in the public political life of our nation as time has passed, and today is no different. And all the history of it might give us some understanding about why the current situation is so complicated in this whole picture. Well, one, and then two, you're going to find out as we go along that part of the problem is that speaking of Catholic vote as a term is really misleading. It's tossed around all the time, but there's no such thing anymore. There really isn't. And we'll get to what that means toward the end. So, Catholic vote, quote-unquote, depends very much on how one wants to define it. That's one thing we're going to find out as we go along. And it shifts all the time. So this election has shifted yet again from the last election in terms of what, quote-unquote, Catholic vote even means. So we'll come back to that in a second, right? So first of all, just in terms of some historical summary points that kind of get us up to today. And you've heard some of this perhaps before from me, and if you know your history, this will not sound too unusual, okay? From the beginning, as I mentioned, Catholics have always had a challenging time finding a comfortable home in the American political scene. There was a stretch of time, which we'll get to in a second, where we were quite at home in one political party, but for a lot of our history, it didn't line up very neatly. So I make the point because if we find ourselves right now kind of maybe say frustrated or aware that Catholics don't seem to line up on either party has not been very well by practice, that's nothing new. It shouldn't really surprise us. It's been that way for a long time, depending upon the decade that we're talking about. So go back to the earliest days of our country. One thing we should know about, in case you don't, many of you probably do, that America has, for much of its history, been very anti-Catholic in its tone and in its sentiment. That was true from the very first days of our foundation. So, and it was true in a systematic kind of fashion. Reasons. So, first of all, for the first 100 years or so of America's existence, let's call this up to the 1880s, 1890s, every Catholic who was here wasn't really born here. They came over here from someplace else. Or they were first born of immigrants who came over here from someplace else. So we were, for the first 100 years of our time in America's existence as Catholics, immigrants. We were immigrant religious, okay? So that meant that we were held in a lot of suspicion. So there was a real allure to come to this country from Europe if you were a German Catholic or an Irish Catholic or an Italian Catholic, you know, whatnot, because unlike Europe, we didn't have religious wars over here. We were good about that. The Constitution and its amendments guaranteed our freedom of worship. That was true legally. However, in everyday practice and parlance, heavily anti-Catholic atmosphere here for a long, long time. So it was anti-immigrant, mainly because people just did not trust the newcomers, and that's not uncommon even in our day to day. We tend to be kind of nativists even in our own day. But also because the ruling class of America, especially New England, the colonial states, or the colonies, the mid-Atlantic states, they were heavily white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, okay, in their particular disposition and their background. And in those days, not so much right now, but back then, the mainline Protestant churches in this country were, by their own operating language and definition, anti-Catholic. They just were in their rhetoric, and we argued all the time, the Catholics and the Protestants, right? So they held the heights, if you will, of the universities on the East Coast, of the halls of power in the capital of the states and of the nation. So white Anglo-Saxon Protestant was the language, plus they were anti-immigrant, many of them, so Catholics were just not at home. Okay. Know, too, that the Republican Party, the current GOP, okay, didn't come into existence until the 1850s, just before the Civil War broke out in its really heated phase in 1861. So 1850, 1855 or so, the party forms, and one of the strands that comes together to form the GOP is from what's called the Know Nothing Party. It was a political movement of the time in the 1850s. The Know Nothings were, among other things, openly and abashedly anti-Catholic and anti-immigrant. They were a nativist party. And so from the very first days of the GOP's founding, Catholics held them in a kind of suspicion. Some Catholics did, because everybody's memories they remembered that this group was part of this whole new GOP party enterprise, right? So the Catholics weren't always at home in the GOP right off the bat either. And again, anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic. The government institutions, White House, Congress, courts, school systems, were almost all mainline Protestant. Okay? So part of why Catholics began our own school system, parish schools, there was a time from the 1880s onward when the bishops in this country said every single parish must have its own school, no matter how small, because they did not want their Catholic students in the Protestant public schools. The public schools were Protestant because they were government-backed, okay? So while America has never been officially one that endorses any particular religion because the First Amendment doesn't let us do so, the fact is in practice, the institutions that were public in this country, right down to the park system, all Protestant in their particular outlook. So we made our own little parallel society, hospitals, orphanages, schools, whatnot. That's how it all began, because they didn't want Catholic kids getting taught Protestant things in our schools. Issues of concern to Catholics in the late 19th century, early 20th century, would have been something like this. So if you're going to try and figure out, okay, then where do the Catholics land if the Republicans had a reputation for being, in the beginning, anti-Catholic, immigrant, and nativist, and if the establishment was anti-Catholic, then where did we end up landing? It was issue-driven, by and large. So issues of importance for us as Catholics once upon a time in the late 1800s would have been things like protecting rural life and agriculture. We were immigrant farmers in lots of parts of the Midwest and to the east of us here, and so we had a great interest in the fact that property was available and affordable as immigrants came over by the boatload into our territory here. So farming rights, rural life, and also in the cities, new property to immigrants, housing availability, whatnot. And then in the cities, okay, Catholics were very concerned about protection of common laborers in the big cities, factory workers, mines, industrial settings. Those workers were almost all Catholic because they were almost all immigrants. Okay, so the Irish especially, but the Poles, the Germans who were Catholic, and Lutheran as well, too, the Italians. We were the laborers in the economic engine of the late 1800s, early 1900s of this country. So what were our chief interests? Protecting our husbands, who would often get killed on the factory floors or in the mine explosions or whatever, back before there was any protection for workers. Knights of Columbus, many of you know this, starts as a insurance society mechanism to protect and care for widows whose husbands were killed at work in the new scary American enterprise and workplace. Okay? So we were concerned about those things. We wanted freedom to operate our Catholic schools without interference, our hospitals, our orphanages, without being forced to become mainline Protestant, and some local movements would sometimes make us try and do things in ways that we said were unfair to our faith, so that was always a simmering issue with us. So on these issues, okay, so rural life, immigrant rights, workers' rights, labor unions, etc., and independence of our institutions to become Catholic in their identity, we would not have been in the Republican camp. Because the Republican Party, after the Civil War was done, moved on very quickly to interests of tariff, trade, big business, and the perception was, rightly or wrongly by the Catholics, that the GOP was essentially the party of the wealthy merchant business class of this country that didn't care about the immigrants. Okay? So we're not really at home in the Republican Party for the first, you know, probably 50 years of its existence. On the Civil War and things like slavery, many Catholics did not see this as our fight. Catholics were mainly in the North, or very few in the Southern territories, the Southern states, so it was a Northern issue. And in the North, some Catholics were quite opposed to slavery, and they were abolitionists, especially by religion and by temperament, fine. But other strong sectors of Catholics up in this part of the country, especially in Wisconsin, weren't interested in the argument, the Germans especially. There is record of the fact that the seminary here in Milwaukee, in order to avoid Lincoln's Civil War draft, the seminarians went to Canada, and they got away from it because they said, this is not really our fight. I have letters from my German relatives who moved here in the 1840s, 50s, who writing home to Germany saying this awful war, you know, awful Lincoln, awful this, you know. We were getting sucked into a fight that we didn't think was our problem. So where you landed on it, so it's not as though slavery, like say abortion today, was a single issue situation of party allegiance back then. It was not. It depended upon where you live, what country you came over here from, what language you spoke. Politics was local, then and now. Okay? There were common cultural values back then in the 1800s, 1900s, shared by mainline Protestants and Catholics alike. So for example, back then, unlike now, nobody would have argued about, for example, the problems with divorce, about protecting marriage and family life. Until the 1920s, contraception would have been something that both mainline Protestants and Catholics were opposed to, so that was not a dividing issue. So the kind of cultural family issues that are explosive today would have been all in common back then among both parties, Democrats and Republicans or the Whigs alike. What we did break down a little bit, though, would be things like I mentioned slavery, but also the question about alcohol and prohibition. You might imagine the Catholics were not generally in favor of prohibition or forbidding alcohol. We were heavily drinking immigrant families, and we had altar wine. So the church says, look, this is devastating, this is damaging to us, this amendment that you're trying to push through, okay, the Temperance Society. But it even divided the Catholics, because there were some Catholic camps who went with the Temperance Society movement and went in favor of the giving up of all alcohol completely. So even that kind of split the Catholic vote and allegiances during around the time of that particular situation in our nation. Curiously enough, on things like slavery, the war, and on alcohol, the mainline Protestants who did most of the fighting about this used the Old Testament to justify both of their sides, depending upon whose side you were on. So the Bible-based Christians used the Bible to argue their point either way, in the South for their cause, the North for their cause, for alcohol, anti-alcohol. So the Bible has always been this kind of source of tension in American politics that hasn't really solved a lot of anything when divorced from its long context of church teaching, as a Catholic would understand. Okay. Some of the divisions among the different Christians, among the different Protestant Catholic camps, among Republican Democrat, were overcome by common enemies. So the idea that as nations would become challenging around us in different respects, we would unite around a common foe, so that sometimes brought us together. But the point is, through, you know, 1800s to 1900s to about the Depression era or so, it was a mixed bag, and Catholics were generally not in the Republican camp because our interests drove how we voted. Not unlike today, right? The next chapter is Catholics become Democrats. That's what begins to happen. They align with the Democratic Party in the 20th century in droves. And how does it happen? because the Democrats become more and more the party that stands up for the laborers and the immigrants and the farmers. And that was by and large the Catholics in our nation. In 1919, the U.S. bishops released a called the Program of Social Reconstruction, which put the church firmly behind the endorsement of government policies that created a social safety net, a minimum wage, labor unions, support of the poor, working families. So the Catholic Church threw all of our weight behind government social safety net kinds of policies. And that is a heritage from Europe. And in Europe, there was this Christian democratic kind of strain that was already at work, or Christian socialism, you might say, that was at work on the continent that made its way over here. So that strain is in the Catholic voting preferences even to today. And so it goes way back in our history, right? This put the Catholics, by and large, behind the Democratic Party for about 40 years, through the New Deal and all the way to Johnson's Great Society in the 1960s, okay? The Catholics harbored a distrust for the industrial commercial elite of the country, which was the GOP's power base in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s. And then the Great Depression happens and causes a widespread public rejection of the pro-business policies of the GOP, and the pendulum swung all the way to the left to Roosevelt and Truman, who rode that for two decades, taking Catholics and non-Catholics alike into the Democratic fold for a long time. So for a while, the Republicans had, like, nobody in their camp, Catholics and non-Catholics alike. Roosevelt comes, of course, obviously, and World War II and the New Deal, and all that Roosevelt did to move the country forward in very hard times and protect the disenfranchised with his programs, that cements the Catholic-Democratic Party alliance for decades to come. So, you know, ask people my parents' age and then their parents' age, you know, they would say, you know, there is no way a Catholic would ever not be a Democrat. It was just what you understood in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. It was a fact. And they vote democratically by like 80, 90% all the time. Kennedy is the beginning of the splintering, okay? Because some interesting things begin to happen in his presidency. So first of all, as of now, we'll see what happens in 10 days, Kennedy is the only Catholic who holds office in this country as a president who was elected to the office, right? So the only Catholic president we had, Kennedy. What he does, though, maybe intentionally, perhaps unintentionally, is he would plant the seeds of the demise of the Democratic stronghold on the Catholic voters. This would come to pass about a decade or so later, maybe two decades after his election, but he begins to kind of sow the seeds of what's going to tear it all apart. And he does it in this way. He knows that as an Irish-born, you know, East Coast Catholic in a still very anti-Catholic, Protestant-run country, post-war but still very Protestant, he cannot get elected to national office while hanging on publicly to his Catholic faith. He has to create the impression that he's not going to be loyal to the Holy See, and to get himself elected, he has to kind of sacrifice, you might say, his public Catholicism on the altar of his political ambitions. It's simply the reality of the day. So blame him rightly or wrongly, that's what he had to do. So what does he do in the face of all the anti-Catholic bias in America and the ruling apparatus? So he gives this famous speech in September 1960, which maybe you've heard of, to the Houston Ministerial Association, September 12, 1960. And needing to appeal to the whole country to get elected, not just the Catholics, he says this, and here's his quote, very famous. "I believe in America, the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be a Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or no school is granted any public funds or political preferences, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him." So essentially what he's trying to say is, I am not taking orders from the Vatican. They don't run me, and I will not run the country as a Vatican stooge. That's what he was trying to say. So what he does here is he introduces the idea that's become very popular now, if I could put it succinctly, that he can be, say, Catholic in his heart, and Catholic on like a Sunday morning to go to the church down the street from, you know, where he went to Georgetown to Mass, right? But publicly, as a legislature, as a person in public office, as the executive officer of the country whose job it is to enforce our laws, I am not going to be a Catholic, I'm going to be everybody's president. So this divide opens up between public and private and Catholic public life. And that's how he overcomes the anti-Catholic bias and puts people at ease, and he barely ekes in 1960, and he does win as the only Catholic president we've ever actually had. Barely, but he does. So he begins this kind of precedent, you might say. And it's going to go wider as the 1960s rolls on and things begin to rapidly change on the front of the sexual revolution. Okay? The Catholics will shift too as a group of people, which we'll get to in a second, in the 60s and the 50s before that too. We move to the suburbs, we go to college on the GI Bill, and we come home from World War II. Droves of us go to college, we get educated in whatever colleges teach people back then and now. And you change, you're no longer the immigrant church you used to be, you're now mainstream, and your ideas begin to shift, and your allegiance starts to shift, and you fracture as a voting bloc. So Kennedy is the beginning of it, his statements do not help it, and the demographics push it even further. As the 60s get into the 70s, here is where things really do come apart, because Kennedy makes it possible now for the idea that a bunch of Democrats in the Democratic Party can align themselves with positions that were contrary to church teaching on family life, especially abortion, while still claiming to hold on to their Catholic faith. They widen this divide as much as they can. And it comes to a head over the issue of women's rights and abortion in the 70s. Because what starts to happen is the Democratic Party begins to plant its flag on the side of the women's movement that aligned itself with the abortion lobby in this country. And as the years would pass, the U.S. bishops got more and more nervous about the fact that while they were such Democratic sympathizers in their history because of Roosevelt and everything else, they couldn't reconcile that with a party that was in favor of abortion. They could see it was tearing apart the voting bloc that they were sitting on top of for a couple of decades. So they began to make it known they weren't happy about this. Okay? The Democrats, citing Kennedy as something of a flag bearer, went their own way. So in the early 80s, you know, so Reagan gets elected and he puts himself and the Republicans squarely on the side of the evangelical Christians to the right, who were decidedly anti-abortion and pro-life, and that's where the divide really kind of cements itself that exists all the way until today. Reagan wins in 84 in a landslide, takes every state except Minnesota, and at that point, landslide means a bunch of Catholics went for Reagan. By the 84, therefore, the unquestioned allegiance of Democrats and Catholics was broken. It had stopped, and abortion was really what blew it up. If you really come right down to abortion, women's rights, and family policies, so-called, on the Democratic side that were definitely contrary to Catholic teaching about marriage and family life. That's where it all came unraveled, on the heels of Kennedy's own personal public divide issue that he put into the public square to get elected. changes were happening in the church, too, that drove changes in the quote-unquote Catholic vote, so-called. First of all, the unquestioned authority of bishops and priests that existed in the immigrant church eroded substantially in the 1960s when Catholics went into the mainstream of life and with Vatican II. So you go to the suburbs, you get jobs, your pay increases, you're no longer immigrant people, you make your own decisions about contraception and about family policies, and all of a sudden the bishops are not speaking for you anymore, I can speak for myself. This becomes the Catholic attitude. So for a long time, the voting bloc was monolithic behind the bishops. Not so much anymore, beginning in the 1960s. So bishops couldn't deliver votes like they used to, and machine party bosses from either party knew that, and so this starts to erode, and we become more, increasingly so, with every passing election, more of an irrelevant bloc in the electorate, because those who are in public office recognize that we don't have the weight that we used to. This is what started to happen in the 60s and 70s. Lay Catholics and clergy begin to have divides over contraception, and as time passes also, the permissibility of divorce and alternative family structures, this begins to splinter inside the church. Through the 80s, okay, the American bishops issued two major pastoral letters, which were largely ignored by the mainstream Catholics. Okay, one was on defense, on the nuclear missile crisis, national defense, and the other was on the economy, which Archbishop Weakland was the major architect of when he was Milwaukee's Archbishop. And so the bishops put out this pastoral letter on the economy, which said we should be thinking about one way. In 84, all the Catholics went for Reagan and went another way. So they essentially said we can think for ourselves on economics too. So the bishops and the faithful began to part company on a variety of topics beginning in the 1980s. The clergy abuse scandals of the 2000s all the way to the recent waves of it further erode the authority of the church, of bishops, of clergy, on public policy matters, to the point where now when we speak, nobody cares. Let's be honest. That's just where it has come down to. So the church's influence as a voice that shapes public policy has declined for decades. The latest nail in the coffin, so to speak, okay, on the quote-unquote Catholic vote would be this. In 2019, the number of American Catholics, or number of Americans calling themselves Christian was 65%. Now that may sound like a lot to you, but that's down 12 points from 2009. So those saying they have no religion is up to 26% from 17% 10 years earlier. So every 10 years, it's going up by 10 percentage points, which means that by, say, 2030, America will be like a 50-50 Christian, non-Christian nation, which is a huge shift for us as a nation, huge. Okay? So these are called the nuns. This is what demographic groups call these people. The nuns are those who identify as having no religion at all. Say, like 30 years ago, there were no nuns. Today, they make up, as I said, 65, almost 70% of the American population, or excuse me, 30% of the population, okay? That's a dramatic rise in non-religious people in this country. That has big implications for how we vote, for our politics, for our culture, for our institutions. That is eroding the authority of the quote-unquote Catholic vote. In 2015, so 5 years ago, half of American adults who were baptized Catholic had left the church at some point, half. 11% came back, but 28% have permanently stayed away. That was 5 years ago. It's gotten worse since then. I couldn't find the recent numbers, but those are already pretty tough, right? So there's a big block of ex-Catholics in this country who are baptized but do not practice anymore. But when a pollster calls them and says, "Are you Catholic?" they say, "Yes, I am." Okay. So what's beginning to emerge here, and you're figuring this out, is that Catholic now means different things, and it's messing up what you call the quote-unquote Catholic vote. We don't have a Catholic vote anymore, right? There's several decades now without a strong Catholic political party affiliation, so that's kind of the moral of the story up to this point. So we had one situation in the late 1800s, kind of a divided block. We had a Democratic stronghold in Catholic life through the Roosevelt era and up to Kennedy and plus, and then call it Reagan and Ford, we have this mixed allegiance ever since. It's been splintered all of my life. I'm 42 soon, and for my 40 years of life, it's been like this, as this divided electorate among the Catholic allegiances, okay? And it's all along issues, right? The perception persists that the Democratic Party, rightly or wrongly, is the party of the poor and the needy, and is therefore the Catholic social justice party that we ought to be supporting. That's a perception. The GOP has forged an alliance, who knows how long that will last, but right now we have it, with the evangelical Catholics and evangelicals on cultural issues of marriage, abortion, and religious freedom. So those things are pushing the groups in separate camps. So the Catholic vote's essentially split. That was all true going into the late 2000s, right? As in the last couple decades. Now heading into election 2016, so Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, heading into that situation, this got even more complicated, largely because of the question of the court. The Supreme Court was a major driving issue in the Catholic decision in 2016. So the influence of the court today on key cultural and moral issues of concern to church-going Catholics further complicates this whole picture. Many Catholics justified supporting Donald Trump on the grounds that he would appoint Supreme Court and federal justices that would be more sympathetic to a Catholic position on marriage, abortion, and the exercise of religious freedom. And as it turns out, this week will be, in theory, confirming a new Catholic Supreme Court justice. That gamble paid off for those who supported Trump on those grounds 4 years ago. How that will shake out long term is hard to say because, as you know now, this is how it goes in policy these days. If you poke the other side of the eye long enough, they're just going to poke you back in the eye when they're in power. So Senator Biden talks about expanding the court, about adding more states to the union now. So this will not be done just because we're going to put Amy on the court. It doesn't really fix a whole lot on one level as the politics gets uglier and uglier, okay? Sidebar, back to that later. Point is, the court now has become a Catholic issue in the elections in a way it never used to be, because the court never used to be the major cultural decider like it is today. Now it decides everything of major importance to us as believers. Pope Francis has also complicated the picture, okay? And this is, I wrote this before this last, what day is today? Sunday? This last Thursday's public communications disaster from the Vatican. I will just call it what it is. on civil unions, even before he opened his mouth about that. In 2016 and 2020, what begins to happen is that under Pope Francis, again, rightly or wrongly, he has been more vocal in his support for political platforms and policies that would favor open borders and government-backed social welfare programs, and he has been less vocal than his predecessors, John Paul II and Benedict, on topics like abortion and the defense of marriage and classical sexual norms. I do think that Pope Francis believes in these things. He understands the Church's teaching, but he doesn't, trumpet them in the same way that, say, John Paul II would have, or like even a Benedict would have. So it creates the impression among some Catholic voters that the issues have become equalized. Abortion is on the same plane, you might say, as immigrants' rights. And the Francis papacy, in its tone, intentionally or unintentionally, only he can tell me, I guess, has kind of equalized those things in the minds of some people. He has, in his own way, Pope Francis, sent public messages of veiled and even open criticism of President Trump, leading some to believe that Trump could not be a valid Catholic choice for president if the Pope himself is dismissive of him. So one could say, well, how could I be a good Catholic and vote for Trump when the Pope doesn't like him? One could get that impression if one is paying attention to the headlines along the way. In this way, the current electoral situation is something like an odd switch of the Kennedy one in 1960, as the Catholic Democrat who wanted to win by downplaying his Catholicism and loyalty to the Vatican doctrinal authority, because now President Trump has, to some extent, presented himself, rightly or wrongly, as the better Catholic candidate and Republican precisely because he and the current Pope are at odds on areas of policy emphasis that are important to church-going Catholics. He's almost trying to say, precisely because Francis and I don't agree, I'm the better choice for serious Catholics. He's playing this card, right? Kennedy played the opposite card. President Trump tries to appeal directly to the papal Catholic legacy of John Paul II more than he does to Pope Francis. So that plays off of the current shift in the church among the pontificates, right? Complicating things even further, racial and identity politics in the 2020 election, okay? If you're a Catholic, you ask the question, which of the candidates and which of the parties and which of the agendas out there is the more Catholic voice when it comes to racial tensions in this country? Depending upon how one wants to read the causes and the solutions to the current civil unrest, okay, you're gonna land on different sides of this. Bishops and clergy have rightly decried racism as a moral evil and a sin, that's true, but they've offered no concrete policy solutions to deal with it, which are they're good at that, right? They say this is really bad, and they have nothing to help it, okay? So that leaves a Catholic to say, well then, how do you fix this problem, right? To the extent, I have to say this very carefully, to the extent that Trump is perceived as a racist, he's not viewed as acceptable by Catholic voters. On the other hand, to the extent that his law and order approach is viewed as the classic Catholic answer based on stable legal framework and a just social order and the need for personal accountability and rule of law, then he becomes a better Catholic candidate if you are a Catholic of those sensibilities, right? So you go either side if you're a Catholic on this question, depending upon what you think the problem is and the solution is, okay? COVID has also messed this whole thing up too. It's messed up everything else, why not mess up an election, right? So if you're a Catholic, you ask the question, which of the two major candidates represents the better voice on COVID-19 from a Catholic perspective, okay? And this is extremely dicey, right? So if you're gonna lean Republican pro-Trump as a Catholic before COVID, we've had to assess those people whether his more hands-off approach to the virus and public safety protocols is morally responsible, especially when it comes to caring for the vulnerable as defined by the media. So if the argument is that an authentically pro-life candidate should be the one advocating all these COVID public safety measures, then President Trump is not taking the Catholic approach in his hands-off approach. Okay? That would be one way to spin this, right? So some have thought in good conscience, I can't support this guy any longer because if I'm pro-life, I need to protect my grandmother who might get COVID, therefore I will not be in favor of President Trump's apparently hands-off approach to this, depending upon who you ask. On the other hand, if you're a regular church-going Catholic, COVID has become a question of freedom of worship and personal responsibility. and of the fact that we don't want our churches and synagogues closed down, which means you're going to land in the Trump camp and not in the Biden camp. So it depends upon where your Catholic sensibilities lie, and this cuts across everything in a jagged line. There is no making this tidy. This is such a convoluted, twisted up kind of issue. Okay? So it's messed up everything on that front, right? So bottom line, okay, we ask the question, right? Why can't the Catholics all vote for one person? At this point, you should be able to understand we've never done that, okay, except for like a handful of years under, let's call it, Roosevelt and Truman. Okay? Other than that, we have been divided for a lot of our time in this country. Okay? Now, to some statistics, and I'll be done shortly, right? Here, we're going to see emerging what I mentioned a little while ago, that the Catholic vote, so-called, doesn't exist really anymore in the classical sense of the term, not only because of changes out in the culture, which have been radical in many respects, you know, with the abortion question and the civil rights of the 1960s and the sexual revolution, etc., but there have been major changes in the church which have driven this too. Because what you wind up with, and these numbers are going to show, is that what has emerged in America and in Europe too is there are no longer a there's no longer a Catholic that applies to all Catholics as a label. We've become a little bit like, let's say, the Jews in that there are different kinds of Jews. There are Jews who are ethnically born that way and don't practice it as a religion almost at all. Do you call them part of the Jewish vote? Well, technically you do, because if you are them, you call yourself Jewish. On the other hand, you have Jews who are Orthodox in heavily said like New York and other parts of the country who are very devout in their practice. Okay, so they're both quote unquote Jews in the demographic category of a voter. Catholics have the same thing now. We have observant Catholics and we have those who are Catholic in name only, with those who have left the church. So we don't make up a unified block anymore because we've broken down along the lines of those who practice and those who don't. And they vote very differently. That's what the numbers show us, okay? So here you might say becomes the part where you start to figure out, you know, well, how would I put it, who the Catholic candidates happen to be in the elections, right? So if you listen to the media talk about the Catholic vote, they never qualify this in the first sentence that they utter, okay? They will say, and this is an accurate statement, that Catholics have picked the winner in this country almost every single election. Okay? Like we're amazing, like we're like, I got a crystal ball, you know, like we're like some sort of mystical people who predict the future. The reason is because as an entire group, we look just like everybody else. We have no distinction between us and the rest of the population if you take us as a whole. So it's not really anything mysterious or surprising, it just means, it's like saying the Americans picked the winner every single time. Well, of course we did. That's how it works, right? So because Catholics now look just like everybody else as a whole, we are what's called a bellwether voting bloc. You pick the winner, okay? So it is true, we vote just like everybody else. So, and in this upcoming election, it seems the same is gonna happen again. If you look about last week, the Catholic News Service put out a statistic that said that the Catholic vote, quote unquote, is going for Biden based on poll numbers. That makes sense because right now, if you believe polls, that's not the conversation. The country is going for Biden by, let's call it, 10 percentage points. So we're going to look just like they are. Okay? So they make this like a news story. Well, it's not surprising. But who'd you ask is the question, right? So some numbers. In election 2008, Senator Obama won the overall popular vote, 53% to 46%. He won the overall Catholic vote, 54 to 45%. So the Catholics went for Obama as a whole in 2008. However, and here's where it starts to break down, and you probably know this, Senator McCain won the church-going Catholic vote 55% to 43%. Okay? Church-going becomes defined more and more in Pew, P-E-W, it's a like a statistical think tank, it's a great operation, a great organization. Church-going becomes the observant ones. You go to Mass, like say about once a month, regularly, they try and gauge your degree of religious observance. And if you end up higher on the observance scale with Mass attendance or Sunday service attendance or Saturday synagogue attendance, and they have different markers that kind of define your level of observance, the observant people are called the church-going ones, okay? As opposed to those who say, I'm a Catholic, but they come here maybe at Christmas, possibly. So there is a distinction in the polling data now because they figured out you have to break this down by lines of demography and by religious practice. The church-going Catholics went Republican in 2008 against Obama by 10 percentage points. In 2012, President Obama won the popular vote again compared to Romney and Ryan, 50% to 48%, so only 2 percentage points he eked it out in 2012. He won the overall Catholic vote on the same percentage, 50-48. So no difference between the overall Catholic vote and the popular vote, as always, because that's all the Catholics. However, it does break down on religious lines. If you were a regular attendee of religious services, quote unquote, you went Romney 59%, Obama 39%, a 20-point divide. Okay? So by 20 points, the observant Catholics went to Romney over Obama in 2012. Those who never attend services, Obama, 62%. Okay? So that tells you that something is emerging in the modern democratic apparatus, as in the Democratic Party, that is a draw for non-religious people who identify themselves as agnostics and atheists. Okay? That is its own thing to pray about, right, as you think about the elections that are coming down the road here. Interestingly enough, too, Hispanic Catholics are this increasingly interesting piece of the puzzle because demographic data tells us that in this country, in the Catholic Church in America is becoming more and more Hispanic as white people have fewer kids and Hispanics come into this country and they have more kids and they just come here in bigger numbers. So they're the newest immigrant wave. We've always been immigrant-driven as a church. Hispanics are the newest ones. Hispanic Catholics don't vote the same as white Catholics. They just don't, okay? White suburban Catholics go one way, Hispanic Catholics go another way. In 2012, they went for Obama by 75%, okay? Even though Hispanic Catholics are pro-life by polling data, they're about 51, 52% pro-life, just like the most of America now and like most Catholics are, but they went for Obama instead. All politics is local. There are immigration questions wrapped up in this whole conversation. 2016, the most recent election until the one coming up in a week or two, right? Donald Trump lost the overall popular vote compared to Hillary Clinton, 46.1% to 48.2%. So we do remember he did in fact lose the popular vote, okay? He's an electoral college victor. We've had a couple of those now in recent history. It's an anomaly, but it happens. He won the electoral college, so he's a legitimately elected president because that's how our system works. He won the overall Catholic vote, Trump did, 52 to 45%, okay? So that means he broke down largely along the typical lines of the victor wins. So in this case, it did again hold true. The Catholics as a whole picked the winner. Hispanic Catholics, Hillary Clinton, 67%, Trump, 26%, okay? 67, 26, right? Regular mass attendees, Trump, 56, Hillary, 40. 16 percentage point difference for the Republicans among regular Catholic mass goers, right? Those who never or rarely attend religious services, 62% Hillary, 31% Trump. That's a 30-point swing between the atheists and the Christians, okay? So Hillary, by far, the candidate of the atheists and non-religious observant people in 2016, right? Hispanics and abortion, Senator Biden and abortion, right? This is the explosive issue in the election right now. We hear some bishops, not all, talking about abortion as the preeminent issue that should be driving our decision-making as Catholics. And, you know, the bishops as a block can't ever quite come down on this topic. They've tried, but they keep splintering as a group on how abortion should rank on all the scales, okay? This is, again, the complicating piece for the whole thing, right? It seems to be, I think, a strong driving issue, abortion does, by polling data for white Catholics and white evangelical voters in the suburbs and in the South, who vote Republican overwhelmingly every time. Okay, I mean, more and more in the last 30, 40 years, white suburban Republicans and white rural Republicans are going, or Catholics are going Republican, Republican, Republican because of the pro-life question, right? Hispanic Catholics are opposed to legalized abortion by 52%, so they're the majority, they are pro-life, but they went, like I said, for Hillary overwhelmingly in 2016, likely due to immigration, okay? All politics is local, right? I mean, if in your mind, rightly or wrongly, you think President Trump is going to deport, Donald Trump will deport you or your grandparents, you're not going to vote for the guy, never mind about abortion. It doesn't matter to you because you want to stay in this country, okay? So we I think in our particular part of the world right here in Washington County get very hung up on the abortion question, rightly so, because it is in fact a major, major issue that's foundational to human life and to culture, no question about it. But we forget that our politics is local. We're all white, and no one's going to deport us. And again, rightly or wrongly, the media spins things, of course, but if you are a Hispanic voter, you're going to hear what you hear, you're going to think what you think, and you're going to vote with your local preferences. Even though you're Catholic, you want to stay in America. Okay? So what's the phrase? All politics is local. That's true even among Catholics. It's always been true. And it's really, really hard to make it not true because people vote with their local preferences. Okay? Rightly or wrongly, that's how people do it. Abortion, too, interestingly enough, okay, to go to the Northeast for a second, the Mid-Atlantic states and New England states, they are, by voting group out there and by polling data, 61% pro-choice in the New England states and the Mid-Atlantic states. Okay, so that's the whole Northeastern block of this country, overwhelmingly pro-choice, 61%. That's a pretty strong majority in favor of abortion rights, so-called, in that part of the world, right? That's also by a demographic percentage, at least to recently, not anymore, but it was for a long time, the most Catholic part of the country. Okay? So the most Catholic states in the Union by percentage do remain Mid-Atlantic, New England states, okay? Especially Delaware, where you know who is from, right? But all pro-choice. Okay? So that tells you, okay, that if you are in New England or the Mid-Atlantic states and you're a Catholic and a political candidate to get statewide office or national office, abortion is a litmus test, and it's not so much a question of religious teachings, but more about the prevailing cultural mindset of where you live. My thesis, is that the lifestyle of the big cities on the East Coast and the Atlantic seaboard, Northeast Coast, right, is so heavily slanted against children to support itself that it's just kind of in the air out there that you just accept that abortion's okay because it's how you maintain your lifestyle. Your cities, your level of trade, your technological, gadgets, your housing situations in big cities. I mean, they're just not kid-friendly. They're just not. And you kind of deal with that by aborting children at the rates that they do out there. So when that's in your cultural drinking water, it doesn't matter if you're Catholic anymore, you're voting locally. This is our lifestyle. We're going to maintain it, and then we're not going to rock the boat on it. Okay? That just tends to be how it goes. So Senator Biden of Delaware, Northeast, who claims to be Catholic, is surrounded by a population majority that sees no problem with legalized abortion. So if he were to be publicly a pro-life candidate in the Northeast, he could not get statewide office or the White House. Not possible, right? And he knows that. So he is trying to navigate this reality, right? I am not justifying at all his position on this topic because it is what it is. But you understand how the pressure, just like Kennedy in 1960, is so strong to go one way, because if you don't, you just don't get elected. So this is a dilemma, right? You're going to have to sacrifice principles of life and Catholic identity on the altar of political gain. That's how it goes for some of these people. It's very, very difficult. So, closing summary points, right? It's almost impossible to speak of the Catholic vote in any way that's helpful anymore. So if you hear the term now in the media, it's a myth. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing like there used to be. The last time we had a Catholic vote was probably like, I don't know, Roosevelt. And maybe Kennedy, right? After that, it's begun to fracture and fracture and fracture again, even till the current election. COVID has fractured it from the fractures, okay? So it doesn't exist anymore. Catholics as a whole have shifted party allegiances for decades. That's true. I don't expect it's going to change. Catholics have voted for their cultural and ethnic and economic context most of the time for most of history, just like everyone else. So you want to say, well, back then they were such great Catholics. No, they were immigrants, and they lived on the plains, and they lived in the cities, and they were Irish, and politics is local. You vote from your circumstances. Okay? That's just true. Rightly or wrongly, it's true. Catholic shifts in voting patterns have as much to do with the changes within the church as they have with the surrounding culture. The church has changed dramatically since the 1960s because of Vatican II and everything else that's been such a challenge for us, okay, in the church. So what's now emerged because of changes in the church and the culture is a population segment that is culturally Catholic but is not observant. the two quote-unquote Catholic groups do not vote the same way. The Catholics as a whole, right, the cultural Catholics, so to speak, who probably were baptized and maybe went to a Catholic high school and possibly to Catholic university but don't go to Mass very much, who think of themselves as Catholic in one way, they do not vote the same way as regular church-going Catholics. They are very different. Regular church-going Catholics vote Republican. That's just how it's been now for the past several election cycles, and it's growing with every passing year. Okay? Draw your own conclusions from that about what you're supposed to do at the voting booth. Okay? I'm just telling you what the numbers say. Right? I'm giving you numbers. Right? Catholics as a whole need to be studied in their subgroups for any meaningful analysis. Race, observant versus cultural, a region of the country, that tells more than just Catholic as a label. It doesn't matter anymore. The issue of abortion has been a major factor in the fragmentation and realignment of the parties in this country and the Catholic Party lineages for the last 50 years, but it's not the defining voting issue that many people think it is because, like I mentioned with the Hispanics and Hillary Clinton, all politics is local. They are pro-life, the Hispanics, but they do not vote Republican. They just don't, at least not according to our data, right? Now, this is an issue that I do not think gets much traction. I wish someone would study this because I think this is fascinating, and I think it's more and more an issue in the more observant Catholic voting patterns. It goes like this. Since the Reagan presidency, little conversation has been devoted to the question of how Catholics should vote and do vote on the question of what is the role of government to provide health care and the welfare state. How big should government be? Is it the government's job to be the health care provider and the social safety net, or is it the church's job? No one talks about this topic. I shouldn't say no one. I don't hear talked about as much as I do, say, the other hot-button issues about abortion and marriage and whatnot, which are extremely important, obviously. But I do think that, you know, it's an ongoing emerging question for us to ask ourselves as Catholics, should we be voting for our competition by letting the government run everything in this country? That is a dividing issue that I think is more and more in our political vocabulary, and Catholics had to think very strongly about this. So, is state-facilitated aid and charity truly a Catholic value? I would like to see some good teaching and data on that, because I think it's an important question. Is the government a better provider of care than we are? Once upon a time, no. We were the provider of care. Now it's them. And if you've worked with social services, you realize that they're not always the best at it. Okay, they try, but that's a question I think that could be asked. So, to me, that's a major Catholic voting pattern driver that's not talked about a whole lot. As the nuns, as in N-O-N-E-S, not the people in habits, continue to grow in America, and numbers of religious observers decline, it suggests longer-term successes for the Democratic Party, whose platform is increasingly anti-religious. It just is, right? I'm not standing up here as some sort of a biased person. I don't think so. You can look on their websites. Their platform and their rhetoric and their politicians are increasingly anti-religious. In spite of Senator Biden's claim to be a Catholic, the fact is, based on the numbers I just showed you, if you are an atheist or agnostic, you feel more at home in the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. So as our demographic shifts in America and Christians keep declining and the nuns keep rising, that would suggest the Democrats will do better and better and better as time passes. Theoretically, hard to say. Will this rising trend put pressure on the GOP to abandon its sympathy or alliance with religious voters? Because if you think about it, there's a strong libertarian streak in the Republican platform, and libertarians do not tend to favor social engineering government policies that prohibit or endorse certain personal behavioral patterns. In other words, it's highly unusual or odd that Republicans are pro-life because we're not usually in the habit of legislating moral points such as that. That's usually more of a democratic thing to do. So one could ask the question, at some point, as the Christians decline and we begin to lose our esteem and there's less of us, the Republicans walk away from us because we're a liability to whatever they're supposed to do next. We'll see how the next election goes in a couple of weeks. It may make them rethink their platform. Hard to say, I don't know. But it is a question that we could be asking. How would it go if there was a future GOP candidate that was both pro-life as well as, let's just say, perceived as pro-immigrant? That would marginalize the Democratic Party in a way nothing has in probably 20 years. So these are things that we'll have to kind of watch and see. As Latino Catholics grow, as a percentage of the American Catholic population, and as ex-Catholics continue to grow, the Catholic vote has become even more divided unless a candidate emerges that is seen to be both pro-life and pro-immigrant. So far, we don't have one of those. If we got one, it would realign the Latino Catholic vote in a dramatic way. That'd be very interesting to watch. If the Catholic vote is more and more properly defined as regular church-going Catholics, as in the observant ones, which before COVID stood at about 1/4 of all American Catholics, okay, so in other words, what that means is that if you, before COVID, asked Catholics, how many of you go to church? 1/4 of American Catholics go to Mass every single Sunday before COVID. Now we're half of that, if you're doing really well. We're actually more like a quarter of the quarter, okay? So that tells me that if now the observant Catholics are the voting bloc that we're all interested in, they just become a really, really, really small group of people, okay? COVID has taken what was already small and made it really small. So we will see how this realigns things as time goes forward, which means that potentially a fully Catholic, as an observant, church-going voting perspective, a fully Catholic, observant, church-going voter perspective is going to become a very small minority in the American electorate really, really fast. Okay? We went from this huge block in the 1940s and 50s to a tiny fraction as of today. So the question emerging, I guess, is that religiously observant people vote less and less for the Democrats. The question is, as time passes, do those who are observantly religious have a home in the Democratic Party or not? For whites, seemingly no. For white suburban Catholics, apparently not. For Latinos and blacks, open question. Depends upon what time brings, right? That's the end of my talk. So what I leave you with, okay, is, again, not, you know, who you're supposed to vote for, but just to give you this idea that our shifting cultural patterns, patterns in the church, things around us, have splintered what ought to be a monolithic group of people. The church is supposed to be on the same page, right? But clearly we are just not, okay? So I think that next time we ask ourselves the question with some sort of maddening frustration, why can't the bishop say something about this? Why can't we be over here on this? Why can't we get this figured out? The answer is we haven't for a long time. And it's due to forces that are large and mega, and in certain respects, outside of our control. And for those people who really call themselves, I'd say, faithful, devout Catholics, there's a lot to pray about in terms of where it's all going to go as time passes, what it means for the future of America, which has been stabilized for a long time by a middle class and by Christians, both of which are declining rapidly. Doesn't spell good news for what is next, okay? So if you believe in those values, middle class and Christianity, convert your friends, because nothing else is going to bring it back, okay? That's how it has to be. So there you go. Those are my little tidbits for you to ponder, I guess. I will, just because I'm brave, entertain questions if you have them. Yes. You're asking the question, how does God intervene in all these kinds of things? You are right. It's hard to pinpoint the hand of God in history in many respects. This gets to tomorrow night's talk on Isaiah. I will touch on the very point that you're, that's like part two, okay? So come back and hold that thought. But yes, it's true. You know, the plan of God in all this is its own mysterious thing. I would agree. I'll say this right now, and I mean, you would not find that surprising. I mean, of course, prayer changes things. It really does, okay? But as I'll talk about tomorrow night, you know, maybe all the praying is supposed to send us in some other direction that God wants in his whole bigger picture. It's hard to know it in the moment, right? But can we pray for pro-life candidates and for the culture of life? Absolutely. It's not empty and pointless. America is, by pulling data these days, a majority pro-life country by about 3-4 percentage points. Depending on who you ask, so that's a major victory. It wasn't true years ago, so that's great. But it doesn't mean the parties are going to align that way, depending upon demographics, economics, religious practices, you know, whatnot. So we keep praying and praying and praying and hoping for changes of hearts, right? Other comments or questions? Yep.
Paul, did you see this election as just another election, or do you see this as either great way, as a chance that we could lose our country and all our freedoms?
Every election is important. I know that's often said, but I don't know what election doesn't matter, because they all drive things to the next step, right? They all matter, you know? I mean, why did Reagan win every state except one in 1984? You know, I mean, clearly people saw him as a person who wanted to take us to where they wanted to go as a country in the next step, and rejection to what he had inherited in 1980, which was its own kind of mess, right? But does 84 mean less than 2 weeks from now? No, I don't think so. I think they're all, every election's important. That's why people are supposed to vote, right? Are there major things at play? Of course. I am concerned about where the country is going no matter who wins in 10 days or so, okay? No matter who wins, I'm concerned about where it's going for all the things I just got done saying, right? So I wouldn't want to minimize your point because you're right, but every election really does, they all matter, they really do. Yeah, so you didn't hear him when he says, you know, if the culture is fragmented, why can't the church be unified? Because we're supposed to be, right, as the body of Christ and with the Magisterium, with the Holy Father, with documents. We ought to be on the same page. I agree with you. I really do. At the same time, I do think that part of where it gets all muddled is that, and I've said this in prior election talks, I didn't go into this one so much, but in other times I've done this, my proposition goes kind of like this. On things like abortion, that's a rather easy cause and effect issue to talk about. You know, in that it's a very narrowly defined set of choices with a cause and effect that's easy to point to. It's black and white in terms of its objective nature as a decision, right? So either you're for it or you're against it, with some nuances about, you know, danger of mother's life, whatnot, that's around the edges of it. But nonetheless, on the whole, there's not a lot of room for nuance on the topic because it's a really easy thing to understand in its cause and effect circumstance. You can't say that about healthcare. It's a whole different kind of issue because there are probably 100 different Catholic responses to effective healthcare, okay? So abortion is one kind of thing that we ought to be on the same page about, true. Yet so many of the policy questions that we're very concerned about are much more about prudential judgments of how one applies broad principles. So there could be a conservative answer and a liberal answer depending upon what you think government should do in people's lives. And so if you're a bunch of bishops, you can't get the same page about stuff at all. You just can't. Abortion, sure, theoretically, okay? But I think part of the challenge, and I feel your pain, I sense it too, is a lot of what drives our electoral politics in every era are things that are not, there's no easy A to B line on some of these issues. And it kind of puts us in camp. So when that's true, what takes over are localities. If you are a California bishop with most of your diocese as immigrant Mexican populations, you're gonna look at this in one particular manner because of where you live. It's a fact, you know? So as opposed to say here in Washington County, Archbishop Lestecki, as opposed to New Orleans, as opposed to Delaware, where Senator Biden is from. So localities do impact how Catholics live. It's been true forever, right? Because so many issues are local. So I know what you're saying. We could be better about certain things. I agree. I do agree with you. On other things, we're going to be all over the map for a long time because it's just the nature of the issues, I think. But good point. I agree.
Thank you.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's the right, yeah. It's the question of the nanny state, so-called, right? Who's going to run my life for me? This has been with us as a country from the beginning. Okay, so yeah, it's always in our kind of American DNA to question how big government happens to be. And COVID has pushed it to the next level now. Okay, we took what was already an explosive question about how big government is, and we have ratcheted it way to the next level with COVID stuff. So same thing you're talking about, right? But as you say, yes, at the founding, and it's true, you know, the founding fathers, while they weren't exactly Christian, many were deists, they had very strong Christian sympathies and classical human rights sympathies that depended upon the average population being religiously observant in their way. And so the whole American system rests on a framework of people who ought to be believers. That was what the whole thing was, which I think is what you're trying to say accurately enough. And so when that goes away, as our number suggests it is, then what does one do with the American system? It doesn't exist anymore, at least it doesn't function anymore like it's supposed to. And you have what's called a constitutional crisis on top of a cultural crisis. It's a really explosive situation that we're talking about, which is, I think, your point about how important the election is. I agree with both of you. So again, as I say, you know, if these values matter to you, convert your friends. Okay, nothing else is gonna change it than people saying to our neighbors, we have to realign our thinking on these topics, okay? So yeah, true. Maybe like one or two more, and then you can go and watch some football game or something. Yeah.
So is there any historical precedence, Christianity precedence, to show us that a nation has dug a hole so deep in our, and their own people in it on their own? Is there any precedence to suggest that a nation can get out of that hole by turning faith? You know what I mean? Or are we on the path of the moment?
So it's questioned, if you didn't hear, to paraphrase, you know, is there a historical example where a nation has kind of gone down a lax path in the practice of the faith, has gotten in a challenging spot and come back by becoming more faithful again and returning to Christian principles, perhaps? Yeah, I suppose, depending on how far back you want to go. I mean, you know, Europe is, I guess, the precedent, and their history there is so hard because, unlike America, they went through a long time period of their history where most of their wars were over religion. It was over the Christian question of Protestant versus Catholic. And so, I mean, over there, you're not going to sell them on the fact that Christianity is going to save them anything because they think it's what made everything worse in the first place, which isn't entirely fair. There was France, you know, that went deliberately under Napoleon, you know, anti-Christian and very secular, and then experienced a revival afterwards, became very strong again. So that might be one example what you're thinking about, right? But the population hadn't gone south. The government forced it on them. Here, it's much more organically decaying, I would say, from within, which is so hard. I'm not sure how to answer your question. It's a good question. I can't think of many examples, to be perfectly honest. Yeah.
Changing their way of thinking. I could raise my children that way, and they're learning it in the schools.
Yeah, so it's true. We used to be able to rely on... Yep, I know. We used to be able to rely on the culture to raise our kids kind of for us, and we can't rely on it anymore, which I think is your point. And I would say universities and the public school system, depending upon where you are, have become in many ways what the Catholics feared in the 1800s. Back then it was Protestant, now it is secular. And it erodes their values in a ferocious way. The difference is that now the church has become so secular in this country, we don't have the ability to mount a defense against it like we did when we made Catholic schools once upon a time as the way to fix it, right? So I think that as always, as the church becomes strong again internally and we become more devout in our understanding of things, it will impact the culture too. But it's you're never done. You're always having to be reconverted. You can never kind of sit back and rest and say, okay, now we're done, it's fixed. Okay, every era has to rediscover the truth of Jesus Christ and the principles that are binding for human freedom and goodness, etc. So yes, do your research, talk to your kids about it. All that is important and true. I diminish none of that. So. Yeah, no, I think you're right. This is my last point. I do think that the next chapter in the church's history will involve our continual, re-examination and reevaluation of our engagement with the sciences and with technology. And because your point is good. I mean, you know, in America, the Christians are painted as one group, right, for much of our history, but among Christians, we had different ways of thinking about the Bible, right? So if you ask non-believers today, they'll talk about us, the Christians, with this kind of disdain of, well, you don't believe in science, you don't believe in evolution, whatnot, but across the Christian spectrum, there's all these different ways to understand those stories and concepts, and I think that part of the collapse of Christian America, I think, which is where I think you're trying to say, has been a response to our own growing pains through figuring out the next era of how does one engage science as a church that's always trying to figure out what that balance is, right? And technology and gadgets and stuff and medicine. I mean, COVID's another thing. Right? The whole COVID thing represents, among other things, an inability to adequately understand the balance between health, medicine, and faith, if I can say it that way. And we haven't figured it out yet. We've not articulated the answer to it. So it's only going to turn around, I think, as believers, if we can figure out the language to speak to a culture that's become so scientifically enamored that they understand that a Christian can be a good scientist when science is rightly understood, rather than an atheistic enterprise, which it's turning into in some sectors of science, not all, but some. So yeah, there's a lot to kind of sift through what all went wrong. It's a complicated question, but definitely the reaction against Christian fundamentalism would be a major part, I think, in where it all kind of fell apart. I agree with you. And there's more to be said on that at another juncture. Anyway, you sat through this for a long time. You're so polite. Thank you so much for your time. Happy voting.